Okay, we were discussing the expression in the pasuk, "Vati bakar haaretz hakolam," that the earth cracked open as a result of the noise of the people celebrating the coronation of Shlomo HaMelech. And the Gemara tells us that Dibra Nevi'im b'lashon havoy, Nevi'im speak with exaggeration. And if the Nevi'im speak that way, it means there's nothing wrong with it. And conceptually, we explain that the concept of emes and sheker, truth and falsehood, do not depend on the literal meaning of the words that you say, but it depends on the meaning of the message you deliver. It's the communication. If you exaggerate and everyone understands that you're exaggerating, they know what you mean. You mean there was a loud noise, and there was a loud noise, so then that's not, as no resemblance, is nothing whatsoever to do with sheker. It is not falsehood. And therefore it's perfectly acceptable. The only issue would be when people don't know that you're exaggerating, when people might take you literally, then you have an issue of falsehood. Conversely, it's also true that if you say something which is literally true but delivers a false message, that's sheker. And I believe we mentioned the classic example. It's referred to as Kanya de Rabba, the cane of Rabba. Rabba had nothing to do with the cane. He was the judge. But what happened in the court of Rabba was an individual, let's say Reuven, was Tovea, claimed 100 zuzim from Shimon, and Shimon said, "Hechazarti lach, I gave it back to you." And Reuven said, "That's not true. Mashbiach ani, I want you to swear Shavuos Heses." So Shimon said, "Okay, hold my cane for me." So he held his cane, he got up and swore. Reuven got so angry that he slammed the cane to the ground. The cane broke open and out rolled 100 zuzim. So when he said Echazarti lach, it was literally true because he handed the cane to the other fellow. So he felt that he was swearing honestly. So the Gemara says, for that reason, there's a halacha that when somebody undertakes a shvuah in Beis Din, before he swears, you say to him, "Havi yodea," you should know, "Shelo al daitcha nu mashbim oscha." We're not swearing, making you swear according to what you think it means, "El al daitenu," but what we think it means, to warn him not to pull such a stunt. The poskim say, and it's a little bit mashma in the Tosis in Gittin daf memvav amid beis that refers to this Gemara. The Gemara is actually in the Dharma and Shavuos, that the warning is not delivered because otherwise a person is allowed to do this. Even without the warning, it's absolute sheker. And if a person swears in such a way, it's a shvuah sheker. But people will justify it in their own minds. They think they're allowed to do it. And we want to deter that. And if you look closely at the lashon of the Gemara says, "Ovid inish denishbal das atzmo." A person would do such a thing to swear according to his own interpretation. So it's what the person would do, but in no way does the Gemara suggest that it would actually be legal. So the purpose of the warning was to prevent people from swearing, but if they, even without the warning, if they would have sworn in such a manner, that's a shvuah sheker. It's a false shvuah. And it's a common form of evasion. People think they're allowed to do it. I once had an incident when I was a principal in a high school in Miami, and they were redoing the pavement outside the yeshiva. So apparently, that is an irresistible urge for high school boys to put their initials in the wet cement. But they did this while the workers were still around. The workers got rather upset. So I made a whole announcement that nobody should interfere with the pavement and put any initials in there, etc. Well, sure enough, there are initials in the cement. And your informant network, which you rely on, indicated five culprits. So four of the culprits admitted. When they were confronted, they admitted they did it. And, we worked out a consequence. The fifth one, when I asked him if he put his initials in the cement, I detected a pause. And then he said no. I immediately realized what happened. He didn't put his own initials in the cement. But I didn't let on. So I said, that's funny, like a lot of people have been saying that you did. So are you telling me the truth? He says, yes. I says, let me ask you again. Did you put your initials in the cement? And he said, no. This time without hesitation, because he was ready. He says, okay, if you tell me so, I will take your word for it. So I knew what was going to happen. The four people who confessed their crime and got a consequence are not going to be happy that the fifth guy got away with it. So, things start brewing. People come back. How come he got away with it? I call him back into the office. I don't understand. Everyone's saying you did it. So, I'll ask you again. Did you put your initials in the cement? And he said, no. I says, okay, what did you do? So he stops for a minute. And finally he says, well, I put Rabbi Mendel's initials in this event. So, I said to him, do you think you were being honest? Because I thought it was going to be an opportunity to teach him something. I could have told him right away, but I wouldn't have been able to get the same impact. So he said, yes. You asked if I put my initials in the cement. So I explained him this Gemara, and I told him that's not honesty. You're a checker. Anyway, he ended up with a bigger consequence than the others. But this type of attitude, by the way, the fellow is now learning in Kolo, not in our Kolo, but still learning in Kolo, and he did okay. But hopefully he learned his lesson. But the fact of the matter is, this type of rationalization or justification, the Gemara says, is common in human nature. Of it inish lashpi adas atzma, but it's not honesty. It's really sheker. The Bali Musar say, you know, there is a concept in Musar, and it stems back from Chazal really, and is quite clearly articulated in the Rambam in Hilchos Deos, that when a person feels they have a weakness in a certain area in midos and character, in order to correct it, you have to go to the other extreme. So if a person perhaps feels that he's a balgaiva, he's arrogant, he has to try to act in an excessively humble manner. If a person is a little harsh and cruel, he has to be excessively kind. The idea, you know, the mashal is always given that if you have a piece of metal and it's bent in one direction, you want to straighten it out, you have to bend it back in the other direction, and then it goes back to the middle. So the Bali Musar suggests that if a person finds himself having a weakness in the midah of honesty, then how do you correct that? How do you go to the other extreme? So this is one of the etzes given, to avoid exaggeration. Because even though exaggeration is not dishonest, but since the words are literally not true, if a person already has a weakness in the area of honesty, that could reinforce that weakness. So he should make it a point not to use exaggerations either. Also, another aid to given, a different idea, but somewhat related, is to be precise. Somebody asks you what time it is. So you say it's 3 o'clock, but actually it's 3:01. Is that dishonest? No, because people aren't expecting an atomic clock answer. You're telling something within the general ballpark. So that's honest. But, again, communication is delivered. But if you're working on the meat of honesty, maybe you should say 3:01. Or better yet, you should say, according to my watch, it's 3:01. Is it really 3:01? Probably not. Because your watch is probably not that precise. You know what they say, a broken watch has the correct time more often than one that works. Because twice a day, it's absolutely accurate. But the one that works is close enough. That's usually you don't need to know the atomic time. So that is the eighth of the Bali Musar. But in essence, it is not dishonest to exaggerate. Now, the question, and I raised this question last week, is what was Yaakov Avinu doing? Many of us are familiar with the Rashi, the Chazal, that when Yaakov Avinu came and impersonated Esav, Yitzchak was asking him certain questions, so he gave answers which the literal words could have been interpreted to be true, but he was deceiving Yitzchak. Atazebni Esav, he said, Anochi, I am who I am. Ani, pause, I am who I am. Bini Bechorcha Esav, your Bechor is Esav. You look in the Rashi, you'll see different ways of interpreting his words so that they could said to be literally true. But clearly, he was delivering the message to Yitzchak that he was Esav. According to what we just said, that's dishonesty. Lo al das, I died from Eshbin, al das space, al datenu. So then, what was Yaakov Avinu accomplishing with that little trick? Now, to understand that, we mentioned a concept earlier, but before I get to that, we need to understand that Yaakov Avinu's prime midah, obviously Yaakov Avinu is great in many ways, but the one thing that he's singled out by the psukim to stand out for is his emes, his honesty. And that was most demonstrated in his dealings with Lavan. When Lavan cheated Yaakov and attempted to cheat him many, many times, Yaakov still worked with absolute integrity and honesty for Lavan. Usually, when an employee thinks his boss is cheating him, he'll cut corners, he'll take advantage, he'll do things the same. I'm entitled. It's the way he treats me, I'm doing only one-tenth. In Yaakov's case, it was probably one-thousandth of what Lavan did to him. And yet, he responded with absolute honesty and integrity. So Yaakov was the midah of emes, the ultimate in emes. Why did he deceive Yitzchak? He had no choice. There are situations where you need to do that. First of all, the Bechor was really legally his, but it was something, and the Mefarshim go into it, but it was something that he could not explain to Yitzchak. Derech Agav, by the way, there's an interesting question. I saw it in a parish in the Talmud of the Ran, there were various reasons why Yaakov couldn't really tell it to Yitzchak, because Yitzchak wouldn't be Mekabo, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have told it to Yitzchak. So why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell Yitzchak, excuse me, he was a Navi, tell him, you're making a mistake, the whole future of Kal Yisrael rests on this, give the bracha to Yaakov. Why did we need to set it up that Yaakov had to go through this whole subterfuge and get it that way? And in fact, according to Chazal, Rivka gave instructions to Yaakov to do this through Nevuah. When Yaakov said, I can't do it, I'll be lying, Yitzchak said a lie, Rivka said a lie, kil ascha b'ni, I have a Nevuah, it's upon me. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed the plan to Rivka, but did not reveal the plan to Yitzchak. Why not go directly to Yitzchak and let Yitzchak know, and Yitzchak give the bracha to Yaakov and leave me alone? Furthermore, as I'll say, the different reasons brought down, but the question is, why did Yitzchak become blind in his older age? And there are a number of different explanations, but one of the explanations was precisely for this reason, so that Yaakov could get away with taking the bracha. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes to such elaborate lengths, according to this explanation, making Yitzchak blind, giving instructions to Rivka, and then Yaakov has to go and sneak in. Certainly it must have been, at the very least, a nerve-wracking experience. And he just made it. Just as he left, Esav came in. So this was such a drama. Why not just tell Yitzchak? And he gives a very, very interesting explanation. The Talmud Haran says that the way that this bracha was not a simple blessing. Bracha involved Ruach HaKodesh, it involved Shriyas HaShchina, and Ruach HaKodesh, Shriyas HaShchina can only take place betoch Simcha. A person has to have his simcha when in order to have Ruach HaKodesh. It's the Gemara in Shabbos. Why did Yitzchak want to give the bracha to Esav? Obviously, he felt that Esav was worthy of the bracha. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu were to tell him to give the bracha to Yaakov, that would be revealing to Yitzchak that Esav is not worthy. Esav is his son. Yitzchak's not going to be happy about that. So the sadness that would have created, the disappointment that would have created, would have made it impossible for Yitzchak to deliver the bracha. So this elaborate charade had to be done. It was al pi nevuah, and Yaakov did the right thing. But a person who has such sensitivity to emes still can't bring themselves to lie outright. Technically, it's a lie. I have to do it. I'm doing it because it's a nevuah to do, it's a mitzvah to do, and I'm recovering what's rightfully mine. But there's a certain sensitivity that has to be expressed. At least let me say the lie in such a way that at least it's technically true. So, epis something. very similar to the concept we mentioned earlier. If you recall, we talked about the fact, according to the Ralbag, Avishag HaShunamis was given the job of being the in charge of the supplies of the king's palace, Ochenes, so that she would have an excuse for being in the bedrooms in the inner room of the palace. We pointed out it's a pretty poor excuse. It's an excuse to be there once a day, maybe, to check inventory. Why are you constantly there all the time? But yet, if you're sensitive to the embarrassment, to the busha, you try to do something to minimize it a bit, whether it really helps or not. It's an expression of your sensitivity. In a similar way, we found, I think we mentioned this also, that when in the time of Yoshua, Achan violated the cherem of Yericho, and as a result of that, the Jews lost the next battle. And when Yeshua asked what's going on, so Kadosh Baruch Hu said, somebody violated the cherem. So Yeshua said, well, who was it? Kadosh Baruch Hu said, Chidilaturya Anilach, am I your informant? He says, go throw a goro. So they threw a goro, and they found it was Achan. So who told them? So they threw a goro. Who was the informant? Wasn't it Kadosh Baruch Hu? So what's going on? Am I your informant? So what are you going to do? I'm going to throw a goro. I'm going to tell you anyway. But it's the same idea. There's a certain sensitivity to Lashon Hara. I have to tell you, it's Lashon Hara, it's a Torah, you need to know you have to punish the man. But do I have to say it outright? I'll do it indirectly through a girl. It's a certain sensitivity. I'm not doing it easily. It doesn't come easy to me. And if it doesn't come easy to you, do something, epi something. And it's an important thing to keep in mind, because sometimes a person has to do something which is maybe unpleasant or causes pain, but you made the decision, maybe it's the right decision, and you have to do it, but it shouldn't come easily. If you do it with too much enthusiasm, you know, it's no good. There has to be a to whatever extent you could express that sensitivity without interfering with the ultimate objective, then you have to do that. So Yaakov Avinu, when he had these little clever word plays, it wasn't pshat, therefore what Yaakov said is perfectly MS and you're allowed to do that under any conditions. It was that since I'm put in a situation where it's necessary to deceive Yitzchak, let me at least deceive him in a way that's closest to MS as I could possibly manage. Because I have that sensitivity to what it means to tell a lie. Alright, the pasuk continues. We're at Pasuk Mem Aleph. Vayishma Adoniyahu v'chol ha'kruim asher ito. And Adoniyahu and all the people who were invited that were with him, his whole party, heard the noise. V'hem kidu lachol, and they finished eating. There are two ways of interpreting this. One would be they heard the noise and they continued to eat until they were finished. The other interpretation is they stopped in the middle of the meal. What's going on? What's this whole racket? Vayishma Yoav es kol ha-shofar, and Yoav heard the sound of the shofar. Vayomer, and he said, Madua kol ha-kir yahoma. Why is the sound of the city in turmoil? What is going on? It's very curious to see what's happening here. Everybody in the party heard the noise. And either they continued eating or they stopped eating, but the fact is they all heard the noise. Then it says, Yoav heard the sound of the shofar. Did nobody else hear the sound of the shofar? And Yoav asked, what's going on? Apparently nobody else asked, what's going on? The Mefarshim say, of course they all heard the sound of the shofar, they all heard the racket, and you know, it attracted their attention. But they weren't sufficiently curious are interested, they're involved in their own thing to try to find out what's going on. Yoav detected there's a loud noise, there's a shofar, they don't blow the shofar. The shofar was a very important sound effect in those days. It was the alarm that was used in certain conditions, it was used to attract attention. A shofar you don't blow in public just like that. So he realized this is something unusual, there's something going on, we need to know. Yoav had the interest and the wisdom and the understanding that he better find out what this is all about. Yoav was a true leader. He was, for most of David's life, he was his right-hand man, and he led the armies, he led Kal Yisrael. Adoniyahu, these others, did not have the leadership abilities and capacities of Yoav. To me, it's actually reminiscent of the Chazal in Tisisa by the Chet HaEgel. Moshe went up to Shemayim, and of course we all know the story that Kaisel thought he was late, and they ended up making the Egel to replace him, and some of them worshipped the Egel. Yoshua, during this entire time, was waiting at the foot of the mountain. He did not know what was going on in the camp. Moshe was informed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu what was happening. He came down, and Yeshua is there to greet him. And Yeshua says, "Kol milchama b'machane." There's a sound of war in the camp. Moshe answered him, "Ein kol anos gevur." This is not the sound of victory, and this is not the sound of defeat. Kol anos anochi shamaya. It's a sound. By the way, talking about sensitivity to Lashon Hara, Moshe knew what the sound was, but he didn't tell him. He said, "Kol anos anochi shamaya." In a few minutes, Yeshua is going to know also. They're going to go back to the camp. He's going to see what's happening. Why do I have to tell him? It could be there was no Isser Lashon Hara, because it's Milsa Avida Degli. He's going to see it himself in 2 minutes. But what is not necessary for me to tell him now? That sensitivity to Lashon Hara. But the Medrash brings down that this was actually a criticism of Yoshua. Moshe said to Yoshua, "How could you think that this is the sound of battle? It's not the sound of victory, and it's not the sound of defeat. A person who is destined to lead Kal Yisrael doesn't know the difference between one sound and another sound." Now, I do not know the requirements for smicha in every yeshiva in the world, but I strongly doubt that sound identification and recognition is a required course. Right? What did Yeshua lack? What do they want from him? So he didn't know the difference between one sound and another. But what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying is, a person who's going to be a leader needs to know this. He has to have a certain curiosity, a natural curiosity. He has to find out about things. He needs to know something about the world. He needs to know more than just what he learns in a sefer. And it comes from a certain attitude, and the reason he needs to know that is because you've got to be able to identify what the issues and the problems of Kal Yisrael are before they hit you in the face. You've got to pick up on the signals. People don't always come forward. People themselves don't know what the issues are. So it takes discernment. It takes a certain active intellect, an active curiosity. And you cannot just set back and wait for problems to come to your desk and attempt to solve them. In fact, this is quite dramatically brought out by no less a person than Moshe Rabbeinu himself. And admittedly, if you look through the Mefarshim, there are different ways of interpreting it, but at least one of the interpretations of the Medrash. The Medrash says, it's a particularly more mashma this way, I believe it's in the Yalkut Shimoni, Medrash Rabbah perhaps is more mashma like the other interpretations, but the Medrash says that when Vayar Hashem Kisor Liros, Moshe Rabbeinu was taking care of Yisro's sheep, and one of the sheep ran away. Moshe chased it, and he ended up on Har Sinai. And there was the famous burning bush, and it attracted Moshe Rabbeinu's attention. It says Vayar Hashem Kisor Liros. So there's two opinions in the Medrash. One opinion is that he took 3 steps towards the bush to see what was going on. And the other opinion was that he just turned his head to look what was going on. Once he did that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to him. Now, I'll tell you the alternative shot first, so I shouldn't be accused of deception. It says, the Medrash continues and says, "Ata sar liros, you turn to see, chayecha, that you will be the one to take my children out of Mitzrayim." So some people interpret that second sentence as a separate from the first. He turned around to look, whatever that is, and now a new thing, a drasha on the word sar liros. What is it referred to? Not sar liros the bush, but sar liros in the pain of Kali. So it refers back to an earlier incident when Moshe Rabbeinu had it good in the king's palace, yet he went out to see how his brothers were doing. So it's a remez to something else and nothing to do with the discussion. And a number of Mefarshim do learn that way. And, it's certainly sustainable, especially in the Medrash Rabbah. But others learn that it's a continuation of the same thought. You looked at the bush. If that's the case, you could be the one to take my children out. Why did he look at the bush? Because a strange thing was going on. There's a fire burning and the bush is not consumed. So does a leader have to be a bucky in Hilchos fires? The laws of physics? It's an unusual sight, but you know what? If Moshe Rabbeinu would not have turned to look, we probably wouldn't know who he was. He would have disappeared into oblivion. He would have been a shepherd for Yisrael. He probably ended up with a large sheep farm, and that would have been the end of it. Because he would have been missing a critical ingredient necessary to be the leader of Klal Yisrael, a certain curiosity and interest. What's going on around you? What does it mean? And there's more than meets the eye. Let me look into it, huh? You have that attitude, you could be the one to take Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. If not, I'll have to find somebody else. It makes a big difference. I remember once hearing a story, I think it was about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, but I'm not sure, but one of the Gedolim, that he had his car broke down. And he had to send the car into the mechanic. And when they got the car back to the mechanic, he started asking the mechanic all about whatever it was. I don't know, it was an alternator, regular, I don't know all these things about myself. But he started asking, so what does it do? How does it work? And he started getting a whole education on what makes a car run. 2-3 minute discussion with the mechanic. So somebody asked him, why is Rishu wasting his time, doing this? Are you planning to go into the mechanic business? He says, I want to know. A person should want to know. Something happened. I got the car back. It was broken before. It's fixed now. You should want to understand. For your mensch, you should want to understand what's going on. This attitude, just to want to know, to understand, is necessary particularly for a leader, because otherwise you're not going to catch the issues and the problems until it's too late. And this was Moshe's criticism of Yeshua. Obviously, it wasn't too severe criticism, because Yeshua did become the leader, but he felt that he was lacking in some degree this midah, and according to at least some interpretations of that medrash, that was, so to speak, the final ingredient in Moshe's selection. Obviously, you need the other things too. Curiosity alone does not make you a leader, but it's a necessary ingredient. And here, Yoav demonstrated, that's why Yoav was a successful leader. The people, the others, Don Yoav and those with him, perhaps were not the stature of Yoav, at least in terms of leadership. So Yoav was the only one who took the initiative to try to find out what was going on. Then, Odenu Medaber, Yoav was still speaking. Vine Yonasan ben Evyasar Kohen ba. They saw Yonasan, the son of Evyasar the Kohen, coming. Vayomer Adonio, and Adonio said, Bo, come, ki ish chayel ata. You are a man of chayel. I believe that untranslated for the time being. Betov tevaser. And you will bring us good news. One interpretation of chayel would mean basically a good person. It's a little unusual to use that terminology. It should have said ish tov atav tov tevaser, but that could be that is one of the interpretations of the word. And the concept here is that megagel in schus aydei zakai, good things come through good people, and bad things come through bad people. So here, apparently, he could tell from the way Yonasan is approaching that he has something to say, and he says, "If you're a good person, you're coming to tell us news, then it's going to be good news." The Targum Yonasan says on this pasuk, on the word ish chayil ata, the tov tevaser, are gevar dochil chetanat. You are a person who fears sin, the tov tevaser, and therefore you will give us good news. It means you're a tzaddik, you're a rei shemayim. What is that? A person who is a tzaddik in Yirei Shemayim doesn't want to be the one to have to tell you something bad. So bad news needs to be delivered. He'll sort of shrink, let somebody else do it. He's not interested in causing pain. But if you're coming forward to tell the news, then it must be that it's good news. By the way, I think you see from here, from the Targum, that Adon Yael thought he was right. We mentioned this before, that Adon Yael had a pretty good argument to be the king. And here he's saying, listen, Yonasan is a Yerei Chet, he's a tzaddik, so he's going to tell me good news. Good for who? Right? If Adon Yael's rebellion is bad, and it's a terrible tragedy, a disaster, why would a tzaddik want to tell him something that's good for his revolution? So if you recognize he's a tzaddik and you know that you're a Rasha, why would you expect him to tell you good news? So clearly the reason why he had such an expectation is because he thought he was right. Good news for me is good news is good news. So this was his expectation. The Ralbag, in his second chat, the first chat he says, like the others, that he was a good person. Second explanation says, Chayil comes from Gibor Chayil, means a brave person. And as a brave person, you will tell me good news. What does that mean? People who have courage, who are brave, they're doers, they're active, they're energetic, are by nature optimistic. And when they see a problem, they always believe it could be overcome. And therefore, viewing the same set of facts, you know, the classic glass is half full, half empty, viewing the same set of facts will end up giving good news. They'll say it in a positive way. Whereas somebody else who's not such a chayil, not such a brave person, will interpret the same set of information in a negative way. So I have my best chance of getting a positive report from a brave person. One might ask oneself a question. That might be true in human nature, but where are you better off? Do you want to get some guy who's some Pollyanna, who thinks that everything could be solved and gives you a positive report and gets you deeper and deeper in the hole? Or do you want somebody who's going to tell you as it is and maybe you could extricate yourself? So is it a good thing to be so optimistic? And clearly the implication of the pasuk is that the answer is yes. Obviously, to a point, and we'll see in a moment that Yonasan did not give him good news, but obviously up to a point, not to distort reality, but it's often a self-fulfilling prophecy. If a person looks at a situation in a positive way, he will be able to solve the problem. And if he looks at it in a negative way, he will often go down to defeat. And if you think this is popular psychology, maybe it is, but I could give you a makor in Chazal, and this goes back to Sefer Shmuel, Shaul HaMelech, before his final battle with the Plishtim, was very worried about the outcome of that battle. And you know, it's a very puzzling incident, but he communicated with Shmuel HaNavi's, Shmuel HaNavi was already dead at that time, with his neshama from the grave. How he was allowed to do it, wasn't allowed to do it, it's a very difficult parsha, but he did it. And Shmuel told him, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. You will die in the battle, and it's not going to go well. You're going to lose the battle and you're going to die. When he came back to the army and they asked him what happened, he said, we're going to win. Shmuel said, we're going to win. Getting back to Sheker and Emes, here the literal and the message are false, because he didn't want to discourage them in battle. If he discouraged them in battle, more of them would die. So they had to believe they were going to win, they're going to do better. And that's why Shaul did that. Although he himself knew what the outcome was, he was able to overcome that. But it is having a positive attitude increases the chances of having a positive result. And having a negative attitude increases the chances of having a negative result. So you want to hear somebody who's going to be encouraging up to the bounds of reality. You don't want somebody who's going to be totally unrealistic and distorted and get you into something that you can't get out of. But to have a positive can-do attitude is very necessary. And many doable projects were killed by naysayers. In fact, I think, and I can't prove this, but my own limited experience is that anything really worthwhile doing has a lot of good reasons why you shouldn't do it. There's nothing that obvious that nobody could poke holes in, nobody could tell you why it's not going to work, or why it's not a good idea, why it should be done later, why it should be done earlier, why it should be done in a different place with a different person, this way, that way. There's no such thing. I'll just share with you a little bit how, you know, Yeshiva in Miami got started. This is really not me. I came the second year. But the first year, Rabbi Chait, Ben Zion Chait, was the one who started the Yeshiva. The year prior to that, there was an elementary school in Miami, Torah Semes Academy, which was had the idea of starting a high school. But they couldn't get their act together. There was a lot of different factions within the school, and everyone had their own way of how they wanted this high school to look. And, you know, yes, no, on again, off again, they were draining a cup the entire year. Finally, in June, they abandoned the project. In July, two parents of potential ninth graders came to see the Rosh Yeshiva and said, what do we need Torah Semes for? Why can't we make a high school independently? So Rosh Yeshiva sent them to Rabbi Chait, and this is the end of July. We're talking about making a school for September. So they went to see him. I remember I was in a bungalow colony, in the same bungalow colony with him. All of a sudden they're packing up and leaving. I said, what's going on? We're going to Miami. We're going to start a school. I thought he was nuts. So he told me, you know, he drove down. It's a 24-hour drive. He got there about mincha time. He's very exhausted from the drive. He arrives in Miami with no building, no money, no students, maybe two, but they hadn't signed up yet. No name. And here, it's the end of July, and he's here to start a school. Comes into shul, North Miami Beach, time is mincha. A fellow, one of the Balabatim, name is Dr. Murray Kane, nice man, came over to Rabbi Chait and said, I know what the name, you're here for this new yeshiva? He said, yeah, I know what the name of your yeshiva is going to be. He said, really, what's it going to be? He says, well, the elementary school is Torah Emes, and you're from Chafetz Chaim, so it's going to be Torah Chaim. So I said, you know what, that's a good idea. So now he has a name. Tell me, can you think of any good reasons why not to go ahead with this project? So what happened? There was a shul that was about two blocks away from Torah Emes. It was a little shul that really didn't have too much of a population because I moved out of the neighborhood. And they offered that he could use the Ezes Nashim of the shul for the school for the first year. And they gave him a little space in the office, a little desk, installed his own phone, and that they're in business. They have a place. It happened to be that the eighth grade Rebbe in Torah Emes left that year, moved to a different city. And they didn't have a replacement. So they made a deal with Torah Emes, they're two blocks away, send the 8th graders in the morning for the Mudei Kodesh to join with the 9th graders. And in exchange, you'll send us English teachers in the afternoon. So now he has his secular staff. Still no money. They had a little parlor meeting. Six people pledged $5,000 apiece, $30,000. They're going to get started with $30,000. Their whole budget was under $100,000 that first year. But it had a free building, free English teachers, you know, swap. That swap deal worked out very well because in the end, he only ended up with two ninth graders. So if he didn't have those eighth graders, the whole school consisted of two students. As it was in the afternoon, he only had two students. He tried as much as possible whenever he had a potential donor to come visit the school, they should come in the morning when there was like 15 kids there. But that's how it got started. By the way, of the six people who pledged the $5,000 apiece, only two of them ended up paying their pledge in full. So, you know, whatever. But they got in. There's always very good reasons to say no. Sometimes lesser, sometimes greater. But a person who has that attitude of, Chayil, I'm going to do it, I'm going to get it done, sees past that and he sees the potential and sees the possibility and often finds a way to get the job done. So so according to this Ralbag, your Ishchayel, it says, if there is a positive aspect, right, to the message or to the situation that you witnessed, you're going to find it, you're going to deliver it, it won't discourage us, it won't turn us off. will be able to persevere and meet our goal. In this particular case, the goal was not a worthwhile goal, and the mitzvah was such that there really was no way to do it, as we'll see, you know, exactly what Yonason tells them. But, you know, the message that Daniel is delivering in this pasuk is clearly a valid one, and it's important to know that, that sometimes we can be our own worst enemies by just getting negative and being dominating. You could always find a reason to say no. But if you really want to, you could usually find a reason to say yes also. And if you really can't, then you shouldn't do it. But to come with a kind of negativity, oh, this is no good, this is not perfect, nothing was ever done where everything was perfect. And the ones that do usually don't last. Even if you start out, everything's in place. I know of a situation, I'll just probably end with this, I'm not going to, hope I don't identify it too much, but a certain community started a high school, and it was just phenomenal. They had money. Before they did it, they spent months and months lining up staff and faculty and the building and the campus and you know, a whole layer of hierarchy. It was phenomenal. They were advertising all over the country. They opened up. After Sukkot, right, it didn't take from the beginning of the year until Sukkot. Sukkot, I don't know if it was a late year or an early year. The principal quit. Their enrollment was about half of what they projected it to be. Within 2 or 3 years, the school, you know, closed. But when I heard about it, like, everything is going to be perfect in this. That's not how it goes. Things aren't perfect. Right? When you think you have everything perfect, and that's the basis upon which you proceed, you're probably not going to succeed. When you come knowing, listen, I don't have the answers, but I'm optimistic, we'll solve this problem, we'll solve that problem. Things come up, you'll solve the problems more likely than not. And things will be much clearer. So that's what he said, Yishchai Lata V'tov Tevaser. Okay, we'll end here.
And there's 2 shiurim that started last week that will be resurrected this week. There's been Shnayim shiur given by Rabbi Dov Rossford. This will be upstairs for the Ezer. And the shiur here, that's Lucian Sudhir Wink by Rabbi Shalom Chinsky, also upstairs for the Ezer.